in Stevie's, Janelle's, and Nate's hands and opened her mouth to speak.
Sorry, Stevie said.
Oh, that's okay, it's fine, Carson cut in. You can drink in here.
Allison bit her lower lip but said nothing.
This is Stevie Bell from Ellingham Academy, Carson said, in what Stevie realized was going to be the standard way she would be introduced around the town.
Janelle and Nate were not introduced. The walls were painted a happy sky blue. There were lights suspended from the ceiling in the shape of fluffy clouds, and Carson proudly demonstrated the various effects he could achieve with them. Bright light, pink clouds, a rainy day effect. There were reading stations with beanbags. This man loved a beanbag maybe more than anyone had ever loved anything. A fake indoor tree with a small treehouse, long, low tables for games, and racks of books.
It's a beautiful room, Allison said. The kids are going to love it. We already have loads of events scheduled. Story times, board game afternoons, writing classes.
Carson nodded absently and continued fiddling with the controls for the cloud ceiling fixtures.
My sister, Allison said, turning to Stevie, Janelle, and Nate. She worked here in the library. She passed away.
We were going to put in a mural of Sabrina, Carson added. But
it would be difficult, Allison cut in. I think the room is the perfect tribute to her, especially this.
She indicated a giant turtle in the corner that contained bench seats and a little table, perfect for children to sit in.
She loved turtles, Allison said. She would have loved that, kids reading in a big turtle.
Looks like we're all good for tonight's event, Carson said. Lots of people coming?
I think it's going to be well attended.
Good, good,
he nodded.
Well, have to get over to the camp. See you tonight at the picnic.
Stevie took every step carefully, not wanting to spill a drop of coffee on the floor.
So that,
Carson said as the group got back into the Tesla,
is Barlow Corners. Allison is one of the most vocal family survivors. She really keeps the case alive, stays in touch with the police, that kind of thing.
That's really nice what you did, Janelle said, building a reading room like that for her sister's memory.
Yeah,
Carson said, pulling out onto the road.
It helps me get the town on my side for the show. I spent a few hundred thousand, but if I play it right, the show may be worth in the millions.
Janelle cast Stevie a sideways glance.
Charity runs both ways, right?
Nate said from the back seat. 6. Camp Sunny Pines was a few minutes' drive from the center of town, on a road that ran alongside a low and slow-moving creek. The sign was made of brown wood, with the camp name burned in and painted white. The road wove through the trees for a moment, then opened up into a wide expanse of fields and low buildings. Carson parked, and the trio got their things out of the back of the car. They followed Carson to the large dining pavilion, hauling their suitcases and bags over the gravel of the parking area. Stevie's cheap suitcase had even cheaper wheels, which gave up once they got a stone stuck in them. She dragged the bag the rest of the way, scraping it along the concrete floor of the pavilion and leaving grass and skid marks as it went. Inside the pavilion, a woman was supervising a small crew that was assembling welcome packages while fielding phone calls.
That's Nicole, Carson said in a low voice.
Agree to everything she says, we'll work it out later.
This was an ominous statement. Nicole looked up and noted their arrival with a nod but no smile, and came over while she continued her conversation, which turned out to be about septic tanks. Nicole was a tall woman, probably about 6 feet, with her hair tied back in a brown ponytail. She wore long swim shorts, a fitted running top, and a whistle around her neck. Stevie could see many things in Nicole all at once. Whatever time you woke up, Nicole woke up earlier than you, when the day was young and the sun just born. She made a complete breakfast, which contained protein, fruit, and maybe even a vegetable. She accomplished things that she'd put on a list the night before. She stretched in the fresh air, she forged a trail, she punched into the future with a mighty fist. She knew who she was, where she was going, and why she was better than you.
But go ahead, whine about how tired you are. She will listen. She will crush you with her eyes. You will emerge smaller from the encounter because she has compressed your spine. Or something like that. She had a whistle anyway. After the first general round of introductions was made, Nicole took a long nasal inhale and gazed across the picnic table at the assembled.
"Just so we're clear," she began, "this is a camp. It's for kids to have fun over the summer. It's also a part of a community. Sunny Pines is not about what happened in 1978. That's in the past. Terrible things have happened at a lot of places. You move on. It's not a murder mystery thing."
She stared at Stevie for a long moment. Stevie wanted to politely reply that it was kind of a murder mystery thing, what with the murder and the mystery. But Stevie did not say this because she did not want to eat a whistle.
"So when you're at this camp, you work for the camp," Nicole said. "That means you do your job and take care of the campers. A few basic rules that you'll hear again in the main orientation, but hear them now as you'll be here for a few days. No swimming on this side without a lifeguard present. No night swimming. No jumping off the rocks, ever. No open fires that aren't a part of authorized camp activities. No smoking or vaping. No alcohol and no use of marijuana products. Violations of these policies will result in your dismissal, even if you are here with Carson."
Carson was fingering a set of meditation beads and staring at the ripples on the lake. After that, there were forms to sign, conduct policies to read. They were all given welcome packs, sets of information, maps, and a list of emergency numbers to put into their phones.
"I'll give them the tour," Carson said. "I know you're busy."
Nicole gave him a long look and returned to whatever she had been doing. They left their bags at the pavilion and followed Carson out into the grassy fields that surrounded it.
"She's the head of the Good Times Committee, huh?"
Nate asked. "I liked her," Janelle said. "She's a strong woman."
"I'm afraid of everyone," Nate reminded her,
and Janelle nodded in acknowledgement. "You have your tree," she said. A blissful smile crossed Nate's face once again. Camp Sunny Pines was a collection of brown-timbered buildings around a lake, interspersed with large pavilion structures. At the center of it all was Lake Wonder Falls, which seemed like a weird name now that she looked at it. There were no falls in sight, and very little wonder. It seemed like a nice and ordinary lake, the water a brownish color, and still enough to reflect the clouds and sky above. Little docks jutted out all around it, and there was a floating dock in the middle for swimmers and divers.
"The lake is sort of shaped like an hourglass," Carson said. "This part down here is smaller, flatter, and shallower. Then it gets really skinny. The road goes over that part. The other side is open to the public. It's higher with the big rocks, and it's a lot deeper. It's really like two separate lakes with a little channel between them. This is the child-friendly side."
On this side of the camp, the lake was about 100 feet across, surrounded by a narrow edge of beach, with some swampy, reedy areas, Snake Town, cutting into it. There was a swimming pool, tennis court, fields, and a large assembly area with a fire pit in the middle. Carson showed them all around, pointing out the racks of canoes, the rows of communal bikes, and a yoga and dance pavilion. They worked their way around to the tidy wooden bunkhouses that butted up against the woods. They were built on raised concrete platforms, probably to protect them if the lake flooded its banks. Stevie noticed that while all the windows had screens in them, they also had metal latticework. She suspected this was installed in the wake of the murders to ensure no one could get in from the outside.
"This,"
Carson pointed at a cabin with the word Pumas painted over the door,
"is the cabin Brandy Clark was in the morning the bodies were discovered. As you can see, it's close to the tree line. The first body was found this way."
He led them down a wide grassy opening in the trees, which narrowed to a path about 8 feet wide, surfaced in cedar wood chips.
"Eric Wilde was found right about here," he said,
taking his tablet out of his messenger bag and pulling up the black and white photo he had shown them the night before.
"You can see that he was lined up more or less with that tree there with the double trunk."
Stevie took the tablet and compared the spot. Eric had been found face down with his head pointed in the direction of the camp.
It looks like he was heading back, she said.
It was a dirt path then, so they had a footprint trail for at least part of it. What seems to have happened is that he was attacked and injured, probably at the primary site, and he ran through the woods to escape. He must have largely stayed off the path to keep away from his attacker. He was almost back to the camp when the killer caught up with him. He almost made it.
The landscape and the path looked very much the same. Standing here, she could see that the path veered around the performance area, meaning there was no clear line of sight to the camp. Eric had been close, but not close enough.
Now,
he said.
Ready to go to where the main event took place? We'll need the car for that one.
Nate mouthed the words, main event. They got back into the car and drove over the short bridge that spanned the narrow of the lake. This route continued back past the camp buildings and into the woods. It was startling how quickly things went from manicured and inhabited to entirely forested and overgrown. The canopy of trees was so dense that the woods were dark in the bold light of day. The road bent gently to the left and merged with the dirt track they had seen earlier. It was a narrow, bumpy trail, more holes than solid ground. The Tesla handled it, but was clearly used to more refined surfaces, and the group bounced up and down in their seats like popping corn. After a few minutes, Carson pulled over and stopped the car on the side of the road.
This is it,
he said.
Blink and you'd miss it.
They stepped out into the woods. The air here had a rich smell of leaves and plant life, and the sun occasionally poked through the cover in a thin finger of light, but mostly it was subdued and soft. Their footsteps fell silently on the dirt and soft pine needles underfoot.
This is like being inside of a meditation app,
Nate said, looking around. Carson pointed at a small stake in the ground by the path, with a black ribbon tied to it.
People come here and mark the spot where you should stop your car. The Parks Department takes the stake out all the time, and someone puts one back in.
He cheerfully marched on into the trees. Stevie was about to follow, but Janelle put out her hand, which held a bottle. Tick spray, she said. There are going to be so many ticks in here, and Lyme disease is no joke. Ticks. Snakes. This is why camping was bad. This and every other reason. After spraying themselves, they followed Carson down an indistinguishable path, a random and winding walk through the trees, full of roots and snags and branches that reached out to grab hair and clothing. They shortly arrived at a small clearing. The only thing that indicated anything at all might have happened here was a small ring of stones where a fire had been, with a few melted down candles in the grass.
This is it,
he said.
People come here, as you can see. It's a big murder tour and goth hangout.
The first thing Stevie noticed was that the spot was so unremarkable. When she'd read that this occurred in a clearing in the woods, she expected a wide open space. This was a spot between some trees, maybe a little larger than most, but it wasn't special.
I've worked out all the spacing from studying the photos, Carson said. Many of the trees are still here. That fire pit is about right. People have been coming here long enough to mark the spot that they basically made the campfire area permanent.
He stood on a spot to the left of the stone circle.
There were log seats there and there. Everything here at this site was left in an undisturbed state. No sign of a fight of any kind. There was a blanket that would have been about here. The tray of grass was on it. The box was this way.
He continued on back into the woods.
He's creepier than you,
Nate whispered to Stevie.
How does that make you feel?
Honestly, pretty good, she replied. The path this time was much thicker, harder to walk down. Stevie had to press back branches with every step. This was where the wild things were, quite literally. When Carson stopped again, there was barely a clearing, just a narrow space between trees.
It was right here,
he said, leaning on a thick oak tree.
The infamous box. In actuality, it was a hunting blind.
What exactly is a hunting blind? Janelle asked.
Basically a place to hide,
Carson replied.
It looks like a box. It has a slit open in the side, just big enough to see out of. Hunters sit in the blind and look out and wait for animals.
That seems fair,
Nate said.
And literal, Stevie added, in this case. Do we know what happened to it?
The police took the lid, Carson said. Souvenir hunters took the rest years ago.
So the crime scene walked away, Stevie said.
They tramped back to the clearing. As she stood there on the spot of a notorious quadruple homicide, Stevie had a strange feeling. And not the strange feeling that you would expect to get on the site of a notorious quadruple homicide. The sun was bright overhead. A soft summer breeze came through the trees. Everything smelled soft and fresh. This spot was nice. It was a nice, normal spot. A good spot for a picnic, or to hang out under the stars with your friends. Its remoteness almost added to the feeling of security. It was padded by woods, a nook, a little oasis. Sabrina, Eric, Todd, and Diane had come here, set up their blankets and music and snacks, set about their rolling and talking and having fun. Someone had waited, perhaps behind one of these very trees, for the right moment.
What are you thinking?
Carson asked. What was she thinking? What was the feeling? What was it, this little sensation, like a finger tracing its way up her spine?
I knew it was out in the woods, she said. But I guess I thought it was closer to the camp. This is remote. And it's so...
It's not a place you'd stumble upon.
You'd have to know where to go. There were four of them, four teenagers. One was a football captain, but it sounded like they were all physically fit. So a lone murderer, or even a pair, they'd be outnumbered. How do you subdue four young adults in a remote place like this, that they may know better than you do?
Gunpoint,
Carson said.
That's one way.
But they were all stabbed. If you have them at gunpoint, you shoot them.
And there were drugs in their systems, but they weren't sedated or anything like that,
Carson said.
So they're maybe high or drunk, but they're conscious. Conscious enough that Eric could run 4 miles in the dark.
Probably not gunpoint.
Maybe you separate them. Or they've separated themselves. You go two by two. Lots of killers have taken on couples.
Like Zodiac,
Carson said a little too eagerly.
Make one tie up the other.
Creepy man, creepy man, Nate sang under his breath. This is a creepy, creepy man.
Another thing, Stevie said. There were no other tire marks, right?
Right.
So this person, or these people, probably came on foot. That's a lot of night hiking in the woods. Whoever it was came with supplies. Someone went to a lot of trouble to kill four camp counselors. Who does that?
Besides Jason Voorhees,
Nate said.
This is my question,
Carson said.
There's something messed up in Barlow Corners, something no one's ever gotten to the bottom of. Someone has to know something. The answer is here, if we look for it. I'm a disruptor. I like to make things happen. We're going to disrupt this situation and crack it open. Oh my God,
Nate said in a low voice.
I gotta get in my tree.
July 11th, 1978, 6 p.m. Nothing happened in Barlow Corners. Or nothing was supposed to happen in Barlow Corners. It was the kind of place where things were always okay. Not great or terribly exciting, but okay. There was a gentle hum of boredom that teenagers hated, and adults came to love. You could get everything you required on the main strip along Beechnut Street and Maple Avenue. There was the Ben Franklin Five and Dime, and Unity Hardware for all your basic household needs. The Dairy Duchess, the local diner owned by the McClure family, was good for a quick bite or a family meal. Anderson's Grocery and Deli provided day-to-day food items. For your bigger weekly shop, there was the AMP Grocery 2 miles down the road. There was even a nod to the younger crowd in the form of a boutique called Zork's, where the teenagers bought their t-shirts, posters, and lava lamps. On a fine summer night like this one,
Most of the town would stroll along with an ice cream or a popsicle. The kids would ride their bikes, and there would be horseshoes on the green. But it was not a normal summer night. When faced with a tragedy of this proportion, the residents of Barlow Corners did the only thing they could think to do. They threw a town-wide potluck picnic. 4 days after the murders, every business in the town closed at 3 in the afternoon. Large folding tables came out from the fire department hall and the church basement and the high school events supply closet. These were set up on the town's main green space, the square next to the library. The citizens of Barlow Corners came together under the blue twilight and the long green shadows of an early summer evening with their folding garden chairs, lawn blankets, and coolers. Everyone brought something for the picnic tables. Indeed, people seemed to be trying to outdo themselves by bringing more than one dish. Tupperware of every size clustered on the tables, heaped with potato salads and coleslaws. Multiple families brought along their grills, and an assembly line was created to distribute hot dogs and hamburgers. There was much fussing over the arrangements of the condiments and the rolls and salads. Did someone have an extension cord to plug in this electric-covered dish of baked beans? Was there a way of keeping the bees out of the relish? On the dessert tables, things were stacked too deep. Peach and blueberry and strawberry pies, lemon bars, jello molds, banana pudding with Nilla wafers, fruit salad, angel food, and chocolate cakes. As everyone placed their food down, they had a look in their eye, a look that said that every item was an offering, thanks to have been spared. The angel of death had visited Barlow Corners again and again gone past their door. Nothing on this scale had been seen in the town since the massive festivities for the American Bicentennial 2 years prior, when they had unveiled a statue of John Barlow, for whom Barlow Corners was named. John Barlow was a minor figure in the American Revolution who had stolen a British general's horse and slowed him down on the way to a battle. The town was on the site of his farm and massive property. So when a town was established on the spot, it was named in his honor. On that night, 2 years ago, the mood had been jubilant. All of America exploded in fireworks, and everything was draped in red, white, and blue. Barlow Corners was the perfect American small town, unveiling the perfect American small town statue of their own local Revolutionary War hero. Tonight, there were no fireworks, no sparklers, no bunting or clusters of red, white, and blue balloons, just people quietly keeping busy, filling the Chinette paper plates, putting tape labels on the Tupperware containers to make sure they were returned to their owners. The smaller children, unaware or unaffected by the gravity of the moment, chased each other around the grass as the fireflies started their evening rounds. A few biked or big-wheeled around the sidewalks that bordered the green. Everyone watched everyone else. Around the edges of the green, strangers lingered. There were several news vans from New York City parked just out of view. There were other strangers as well. Some of these were law enforcement, local, state, and probably a few FBI. And then there were simply the people who had come to gawk. Everyone watched everyone watching everyone, while the big wheels and bikes went around and around. An hour or so into the picnic, Mayor Cooper, father of Todd, parked his coupe de ville in front of the library and walked quietly across the green. People nodded in his direction and greeted him solemnly as he approached his friends, Arnold Horn and Dr. Ralph Clark. Both were pillars of the community. Arnold, the president of the local bank, and Dr. Clark, the main physician. Both men had daughters who had been touched by the events and even seen one of the bodies. They would normally have been joined by Dr. James Abbott, the town dentist, but the Abbotts did not come out that evening. Their grief over the loss of their daughter was too great. Mayor Cooper, Todd's father, had only come because he was the mayor, and the mayor had to show up. Mayor Cooper accepted a beer that Dr. Clark offered, and then the men exchanged the polite, subdued pleasantries that were expected.
"How's Marjorie?"
Arnold Horn asked.
"She's been in bed the last few days,"
A nod of understanding from the two men.
I can prescribe her something, Dr. Clark said, to help her rest.
That might be useful.
I'll have Jim open up the drugstore. I'll go over with him and get it and drop it by your house later.
Very good of you,
Mayor Cooper said. They communed silently for several minutes, sipping their beers and watching their neighbors pretending not to watch them. The children made repeated runs to the dessert table, snatching brownies and lemon bars. Mayor Cooper cleared his throat softly.
People are going to talk,
he said, keeping his focus on the dessert table.
About what happened in December.
His companions were silent.
It had nothing to do with this, of course,
Mayor Cooper went on.
Todd had nothing to do with that, anyway.
Of course not,
Arnold Horn said. Perhaps without meaning to, all three men looked over at the Penhale family, who sat off to the side on their plaid blanket. Many people in town thought Todd Cooper had run down little Michael Penhale. It was certainly true that Todd had been a reckless driver. Teenage boys often were, especially when they'd had a few beers. And what teenage boy didn't have a beer now and again? Things happen. Besides, no one knew for sure, and no one would ever know for sure.
Of course,
Dr. Clark added. On a different part of the green, Brandy Clark sat with her older sister, Megan. Brandy hadn't slept a full night since she had found Eric's body. She tossed, she turned, she paced. She put on her headphones and sat on the carpet by her record player and cycled through her albums. She brushed the cat and rearranged the figurines on her bureau and cried and paced some more. She could sit here at the picnic as well as anywhere else, and she didn't want to be alone.
You need to eat something, Megan said.
Not hungry.
How about a lemon bar?
I'm not hungry, Brandy repeated. Megan sighed and stared at the row of hydrangeas that bordered the library. In the falling daylight, they took on an intensity that was hypnotic. Violently saturated raspberry and indigo blue. Above them, the ever-horsebacked figure of John Barlow stood sentry over a town that was bleeding. And all the macaroni salad in the world was not going to heal the wound. But she had to try. Megan got up and walked over to the bank of coolers. She lifted the lids one by one, pawing through the contents, which bobbed around in the melting ice water. She plunged her hand into the water and grabbed a root beer and an orange soda. She might be able to convince Brandy to have a few sips of one of them. This was about all she could do for her sister now. Get her soda. She returned to their chairs and held the cans out to her sister.
Take one, she said.
Brandy wordlessly reached for the orange soda and popped it open. They sat and drank for a few moments before Brandy finally spoke.
Who could do this?
She said.
I don't know, Megan said quietly. Someone evil?
Maybe they'll come back. Her voice carried on the breeze and a few people turned.
No,
Megan said.
They're long gone.
How do you know?
No one would stick around after doing something like that.
They would if they lived here. Or if they were planning on doing it again. I feel like they're here, watching us.
Come on.
Megan stood and took her sister's hand.
Soda's not enough. You're going to eat something.
Reluctantly, Brandy stood and followed her sister to the folding tables that were groaning under the weight of all the food. She allowed her sister to make her a plate of seafoam green ambrosia salad, watermelon, and cake. She allowed herself to be reassured. The thing was, Brandy was right. 7. The green Tesla snaked its way down the verdant back roads and into the center of Barlow Corners as day was falling and the shadows were growing long. Nate was absorbed in reading something on his phone, and Janelle was texting Vi. Everyone in the car seemed to be somewhere else. Looking out the car's window, Stevie noted how different the place looked at various times of day. In the morning, the trees glowed with halos of sunlight, and everything had a freshness and vibrancy that could not be denied. In the heat of the afternoon, the trees were a welcome umbrella from the sun, which still wiggled its way between them. As the sun began to set, however, things took on a strange quality. The spaces behind and around the trees stood out in sharp contrast to the bright places. They were holes, places where things could vanish or emerge into the tranquil town. Doorways. She wrinkled her nose to dismiss the thought. This is how she had learned to release some of her anxiety. Thoughts may come, but she didn't have to follow them everywhere they wanted her to go. They pulled up to the curb by the library. The poles and other materials they had seen on the green earlier were now replaced with several marquee tents, linked together into rooms. There were string lights all around the square. People had already gathered and were sitting at the tables. There was a sound system set up, and a DJ pumped out a standard wedding mix of songs that any crowd could tolerate.
I have to check on a few things, Carson said. Go get something to eat and meet me back here. Keep your eyes peeled.
Stevie had no idea what exactly she was supposed to keep her eyes open for, and that felt like both a fair confusion and a personal failing at the same time. She was working this case now, which meant she had to take everything in. But part of working a case is knowing what to take in and not getting distracted or overwhelmed by the hugeness of the world and its innumerable rabbit holes. Carson didn't skimp on the food. There were a dozen food trucks parked along the street, serving up tacos, lobster rolls, vegan bowls, corn dogs, and ice cream.
How much money is in the box business? Nate said, looking around at the tents and food trucks.
Enough, Janelle said. People like boxes, I guess.
But this is weird, right?
Nate went on.
Building an addition to a library, throwing a party, all to get a town to like you enough to talk to you for your podcast?
Janelle shrugged in a Nate makes a good point kind of way. A lot of things work that way, Stevie said. Albert Ellingham used to throw big events to get Burlington to support his academy. Companies do it all the time. Forget about how we're destroying the environment. Here's a free hat. That kind of thing. Janelle gave another, this is also a good point, gesture.
I'm still going to eat a lot of tacos, Nate said, but I'm going to do it judgmentally.
They wound around the trucks and were soon carrying more food than they could reasonably hold. As they made their way to a table, Stevie noted Carson supervising the unloading of some video equipment and directing where he wanted the cameras to go. He came over and joined the group.
I've got almost everyone here who was associated with the murders who still lives in town or nearby,
he said in a low voice.
Right ahead of us, blue t-shirt with the man in the green shorts. That's Paul Penhale and his husband. He's the town veterinarian. It was his brother Michael who got run down by Todd Cooper 7 months before the murders.
Paul and his husband were talking with Patty Horn from the bakery.
You met Patty before, he said. And Allison. Over there, white t-shirt and white baseball hat. That's Sean Greenvale, Sabrina's ex-boyfriend. It took a lot to get him to come. He owns a water sports business, kayaks and canoes and things. I sponsored a bunch of free rentals, so he had to show up. That older woman sitting in that group over by the trees, the one with the striped top and the short hair, that's Susan Marks, the head of the camp in 1978. And that.
He waved to a woman in a gray linen suit, which was out of place with all the shorts and light dresses.
Hang on, he said. I have an important introduction to make.
He stood and signed to Allison, who was coming out of the library. She approached the table.
Allison,
Carson said.
It's going pretty good, huh?
It is, Allison said, looking out at the festivities. It's very... My sister would have appreciated this. We already have a crowd of kids in the reading room playing games and picking up books. The woman in the linen suit had reached the table.
Oh, this is Sergeant Graves, Carson said. You know each other, right?
Allison shook her head.
I know you, the woman said. Or of you. I'm a cold case detective, and I've been assigned...
The unfinished bit of the sentence indicated that she had been assigned to this case, the box in the woods.
Nice to meet you, Allison said, shaking the woman's hand formally. You know, we get someone new every year or two. It never comes to anything.
I'm aware of that. It must be very difficult for you. But I want you to feel free to reach out to me anytime at all. Here.
She reached into her bag and produced a business card.
Anytime. I'm happy to talk, to answer any questions I can, whatever you need. Consider me a resource.
Allison took the card and looked at it for a long moment.
That's kind of you to say, Allison replied.
I don't hold out a lot of hope, but there is one thing you could do for me. Name it.
My sister had a diary, Allison said. It was very important to her. She had it with her at the camp, but when they sent her things home from her bunk, it wasn't there. I know her things from that night are still in evidence. We've asked before if her diary was there. Maybe it was in her bag. We've always been told it wasn't. But it has to be somewhere. Could you look through the paperwork or boxes again? Maybe it was misplaced?
I've never seen anything in the files about a diary, Sergeant Graves replied. But I'm not about to pretend that things were handled well back then. I'll go through everything and look for it. I'll start tomorrow.
I would appreciate that, Allison said. It's the one thing of hers I really, truly wish I had.
No problem. Good to meet you. Excuse me, I'm going to get something to drink.
I always ask about the diary, Allison said when she was gone. They always tell me they'll look to shut me up. I guess they mean well, I don't know.
I think it's about time to do the honors,
Carson said to Allison.
If you're ready.
Allison nodded, and Carson got up and took his position behind the microphone. The DJ faded out the music, and Carson called out to the crowd to come gather around.
Thank you for coming out tonight, he said. I'm Carson Buchwald, founder of BoxBox. We're here to dedicate the Sabrina Abbott Children's Reading Room, and to do that, let's have Allison Abbott come up.
Allison took the microphone and said some remarks about her sister, which got warm applause. Stevie scanned the tent. Most of the people there wouldn't have been alive during the murders, or if they were, they had probably been children. It seemed a bit gross to use an occasion like this to gather people associated with the case in one place, but the truth was, it was also very effective. Allison handed the mic back, and Stevie expected Carson to conclude the remarks, but things did not go that way.
Now, he said, I'd like to tell you about something special I'm working on. Let me bring someone up here I want you to meet. Stevie, can you come up here?
What? Stevie whispered. What's he doing?
Stevie,
he said again. Stevie put her taco back on the plate, wiped her hands on her shorts out of nervousness, and joined him.
This is Stevie Bell. You may have read about Stevie recently in connection with the events at Ellingham Academy in Vermont.
The vast silence, punctuated only by someone asking for a hot dog, indicated that they either did not know or did not care.
That case was famously cold until Stevie came along and helped to partially solve it.
Stevie had, in fact, entirely solved it, but that was not public. She ground her jaw.
And I knew she was the person I had to partner with on my new venture. Obviously, you have a cold case here in Barlow Corners. Well, I want you to know, we're here to make sure it doesn't stay cold. Stevie and I have teamed up.
Stevie saw Nate rub his hand all the way down his face, trying to block out what was happening. She felt her abdominal muscles tense and flex.
To make an investigative podcast, taking a fresh look at what happened here. And I'd like to get everyone in Barlow Corners involved.
Total, muffled, deadly silence. Even the lightning bugs seemed to sense that this was a bad scene and flew out of the tent.
And together we will get to the bottom of what happened at Camp Wonderfalls.
He paused and looked around in a way that absolutely indicated that he expected some applause to follow. It did not follow.
So, he went on, we're going to be here and working.
If anyone wants to contact us at any time, you can reach me on Twitter or Instagram, or you can message me on Signal. Everything you say will be completely confidential. So thanks, and please enjoy the evening.
Stevie half wondered if he would blow a kiss and drop the mic. Instead, he gestured to the DJ, who deemed single ladies to be the correct jam for this particular car crash of a moment.
Okay, Carson said to Stevie, smiling. I think that went great.
Stevie wobbled a moment in bug-eyed horror, then tried to move back to the table, but Allison Abbott stepped forward, accidentally blocking her egress.
What is this? She said. A podcast,
Carson said eagerly.
Maybe a limited series. I've been talking to some producers.
This, Allison said, gesturing around her. Carson looked around the tent in confusion.
A picnic?
Is this some kind of publicity thing?
No, it's to
buy our participation, Allison said.
No, no. See, I want to help. I want to.
You don't want to help,
she said, her voice like a dull blade.
People always come here to write a book or make a TV show or a podcast or whatever. But you
give us a room for children at the library, all as a way of buttering us up.
Allison was directing all this at Carson, but Stevie was there, curling up inside, as the entire town of Barlow Corners turned to watch Allison remove the bones of Carson's spinal cord one by one. The most charitable of the expressions showed embarrassment. Most were cold and disgusted. Stevie felt herself getting a bit faint. She considered simply dropping to her knees and crawling away, under the picnic tables, out of the tent, across the green, into the woods, never to emerge. Nate and Janelle watched from maybe 10 feet away, helpless. They may as well have been on the other side of a moat full of alligators.
I'll tell you what you can do, Allison said. You can take your picnic and your food trucks and your podcast, and you can shove it.
I really just want to dialogue.
Allison gripped the plastic tablecloth of a nearby picnic table, and Patty Horn hurried up to her.
Let's go, she said to Allison. Let's get out of here.
I'm fine,
Allison said, her voice dry. Allison lowered her gaze from Carson and looked at Stevie for a long moment. Stevie couldn't read her expression, but whatever it meant, it propelled Stevie backward and away from Carson and out the side of the tent. She quick walked across the green, not looking back. She could hear footsteps behind her, and Nate and Janelle caught up.
Yikes, Nate said. Wow. Wow. Wow.
You okay? Janelle asked.
Fine, I just...
Yeah, we saw, everyone saw.
They stopped once they reached the statue of John Barlow. The base was large enough for all three of them to sit, and they could hide around the back. Looking at it up close, Stevie could see that it wasn't a particularly good statue. It was slightly formless, a generic figure of a man on a generic rendering of a bored-looking horse.
It's ugly, isn't it?
Said a voice from behind them. Patty Horn had left the tent and come to join them. She walked up, hands tucked in her jean pockets.
I remember when they unveiled it, she said. They pulled off the cloth and everyone was quiet for a moment. My friends and I burst out laughing. And don't worry about Allison. She doesn't mean it.
It definitely sounded like she meant it, Nate replied.
Well, she probably meant it for him, not for you. We get... tired's not the word. We get inflamed, I guess, when people come back and try to make something of the case. It's like we heal, and then the wound opens again. It was hard enough for me, but Allison lost her sister. It doesn't matter that it was in 1978. I'm not here to inflame or... anything like that, Stevie said. I know you're not. You're a kid.
The slight was inadvertent, Stevie felt, and she didn't take it personally. Some days it still feels unreal, like a story about someone else. Other times, like tonight, actually,
It feels like it just happened. I can remember so much about it. How it felt. It was warm, like tonight. We would sit here on the green or go down to the Dairy Duchess for ice cream. I still go there sometimes and half expect to see Diane waiting tables. She seemed lost in thought for a moment, looking up at the strange metal head of John Barlow. Then she snapped back to the moment. "Want to come over to the bakery with me?" she asked. "Have some cake and relax while whatever's going on over there blows over." She did not have to ask twice. 8. The tiny bell on the door of the Sunshine Bakery tinkled as the group entered. There was a crepuscular quality to the bakery, lit only by the distant streetlights outside and the faint purple twilight. The cakes were dark figures in the glass case. Patty turned on one of the overhead lights, which elongated the shadows. It was a cheerful kind of creepiness. It turned out that the lingering smell of cake was different, and maybe even better than cake in the oven. Someone needed to turn it into a scented candle pronto. "Pick whatever you like," Patty said as she lifted up the leaf in the bakery counter to step behind it. "I've got some leftover red velvet, a golden vanilla, and double chocolate." "Red velvet for me, please," Janelle said. She was back at the counter, examining Patty's work. "You should come back in someday," Patty said. "I'll show you how I make the silicone molds. You seemed interested in that." Janelle's head shot up upon hearing this.
"She's like the Hulk," Nate explained. "But instead of transforming when she gets mad, it's when she sees crafts. And she doesn't turn big and green, she just makes crafts, so not like the Hulk, really."
Patty blinked slowly.
"Chocolate, please," he added.
Stevie walked around the bakery and looked at the photos on the walls. "This is your dad, right?" she said, pointing at one of the pictures.
"That's him,"
Patty replied, carefully lifting out a massive piece of chocolate cake for Nate.
"Well spotted, how did you know?"
"He was in the group photo of the statue unveiling."
"Oh yeah, my dad was in it, and the mayor, and the sheriff, and Mrs. Wilde, and I forget who else. Someone took the picture for a local guide, but they submitted it to Life and it was accepted. It was a huge deal. My dad hated having his picture taken. That picture and the one you're looking at, those are really the only two good ones I have. He was a private guy, hardworking, greatest generation type. What kind for you?"
"Oh, chocolate?" Patty chopped off another massive hunk of cake.
"Allison seemed really hopeful about the diary," Stevie said. "But then she said everyone just humors her." "She asks every new detective about that diary," Patty said, passing the cake to Stevie. "If they haven't found it by now, I don't think they're going to turn it up at this point. But it gives her something to hold on to, I guess. I don't know if it's better for her to have hope about that or let it go. It's complicated. You said red velvet, right?"
Janelle nodded. Another heroic slice was produced. Patty made herself a cup of tea and sat down at the table with them. She pulled the tie from her ponytail, letting her dusty blonde hair fall over her shoulders.
"So this is about a podcast, huh?" she said. "You want to know our stories? I'll tell you mine if you want."
"Do you mind talking about it?" Stevie asked. "Even now?" Patty shook her head.
"It's nothing I haven't said before. I'm lucky to be able to tell the story. I would have been there that night. Todd, Eric, and Diane were my friends, my gang. The only reason I wasn't there was because I was in trouble. I have survivor's guilt. It feels like my duty to talk about it."
Having said she was willing to talk, Patty drifted into silence for a moment. Stevie, Janelle, and Nate looked at each other and ate cake for a moment until Patty stirred herself.
"What is it you want to know? The usual stuff? Who, where, when?"
Put like that, it felt dirty and low. Stevie felt herself contract internally. This was what it felt like to talk to real survivors. It was something she would have to get used to, if not get comfortable with.
"What were your friends like?"
Stevie asked. It seemed like the best way to ease into the nitty-gritty details.
"Fun," Patty said without hesitation.
A lot of fun, most of them. I'm going to sound like I'm a million years old, but it was such a different time. Everything was loose, free. A lot of it was really irresponsible, but we had a good time. Back then, I didn't think about the future. In high school, I was unfocused. Spoiled, if I'm being honest. I was terrible. She smiled and shrugged apologetically. My mother died when I was 11. She had cancer. It was so horrific. My dad took care of me, but he didn't talk much about anything. He was a war hero, actually. Military intelligence. He did something important in the war, behind enemy lines in Germany. Serious stuff, the kind people write books about. It made him tight-lipped and stern. He made a good living, and between his salary and a little life insurance from my mom's passing, we were very comfortable. He tried to care for me by giving me anything I wanted. I had fashionable clothes, whatever was the latest. I got all the records I wanted. I had horses. I got a car when I turned 16, a little MG convertible, which was very cool. We had the house with the big pool. I was that kid. While everyone else was thinking about their education and job, I was never thinking further than the next party, the next drama, the next new thing. I didn't apply to college. That's when my dad and I started to argue. We had some blow-up fights my senior year. He wanted me to make a plan for my life, and he wanted me to stop hanging out with deadbeats. That's what he called my friends. She took a long sip of her tea. You asked what they were like, she said, refocusing. Eric was sweet, funny, a genuinely nice guy. Smart, too. A lot of people have made a big deal about the fact that he sold pot, but you have to understand, this was some low-level, high school, late 70s stuff. He would have gone on to really good things if he had gotten himself together, which I think he would have. I miss them all. But I think about Eric a lot for some reason. Diane was one of my closest friends, but I can't say I ever knew her well. Her parents owned the Dairy Duchess. It's the diner down the street. She was tough, loved rock, loved it, especially Led Zeppelin. Loved going to concerts. I did too, but Diane was a real music person. She was Todd's girlfriend, and Todd was... Stevie saw Patty wrestling with her thoughts. I have a hard time reconciling this one, she said. Todd was not a good person, and I knew it, and I still liked him. He was the big man on campus, son of the mayor, captain of the football team. He felt like a big deal, which is ridiculous, of course. At the time, though, it seemed so important. It's so easy to get sucked in when you're young. I should have stopped hanging out with him after Michael Penhale died, but I didn't. You think he had something to do with Michael Penhale's death? Stevie asked. Oh, he did it, Patty said. I'm sure of that. I was in his Jeep all the time. I knew how he drove. Fast, drunk, high. Someone saw him that night, and the police did nothing at all to investigate. And I saw the change in him after Michael Penhale died. He was always cocky, but after that, he was unbearable. I could stand it because I was on the inside of the circle with him. I think I tried to tell myself it was just a terrible accident on a dark road. Todd didn't mean to do it. I justified it in my mind by thinking that because it wasn't intentional, it was not okay, but not something that needed to be pursued. I'm not proud of any of this. I'm just telling you how it was. Janelle had stopped eating her cake. She was not the kind of person who could listen to a story like that and keep chowing down. Nate could multitask. Stevie was in the zone now, her mind moving through the facts. How did Sabrina fit into all this? Stevie asked. I was never clear on why she started hanging out with us, Patty replied. She started sitting with us at lunch at the end of senior year. I think Diane brought her over, but I never knew why. Sabrina was kind of the queen bee of Liberty High. Did you like her? I think so, Patty said. It's hard to say. I didn't dislike her. We maybe made fun of her a little for being perfect, prissy. But she was nice.
didn't seem to have a mean bone in her body. I wasn't close to her, but it was Sabrina who inadvertently caused me to miss the trip into the woods that night. Patty inhaled deeply and drummed her fingers on the table. At that time, my life revolved around my boyfriend, Greg. We started dating early junior year. I was completely, totally, and utterly caught up in it. I barely thought about anything else. He was very handsome, but honestly, that's all he had going for him. I built him up in my mind as this bold, interesting, free spirit. What he was, in reality, was the town drug dealer, until Eric took over and did a better job. Greg couldn't even do that. He messed around with other girls. I knew it. We fought about it constantly, but I wouldn't break up with him. At some point, he kissed Sabrina. She came and told me, which was decent of her. This was a few days before the murders. I was so upset I left camp, went home for a day, and cried and moped around. But honestly, it was boring being at home when everyone else was there, so I went back the next day. Greg apologized, so I forgave him, as usual. It was one of those teenage things. You fight and you kiss and make up. It was the 4th of July, and we snuck into the woods and were making up. I don't need to say more than that. We were caught by the deputy head of camp and got put on house arrest. I worked with the kids during the day, but at 8 o'clock each night, I had to sleep in the nurse's cabin and help out there if she needed it. At the time, it felt like the end of the world. She shook her head. So that's where I was the night it happened, she said. That's why I didn't go with them into the woods. I was bored out of my mind in the infirmary. I couldn't even sneak out because the nurse had insomnia. She sat up all night in a rocking chair, embroidering. All I remember was waking up the next morning to someone screaming across the lake. Then the nurse grabbed her things and started running. I ran too, because I wanted to see what was going on. And that's when I saw him, Eric. I can't describe it. You don't ever want to see anything like it. This, Stevie understood from personal experience. She had discovered two dead bodies at Ellingham. They had not died in the same manner, but it was something that did not leave you. Sometimes, especially when she was trying to sleep, Stevie's mind went back to those moments. Seeing a pair of feet, a figure on the ground, the stillness, the... She felt herself turning inside, the start of anxiety spiral. Janelle, being aware, pushed Stevie's cake closer toward her and nodded, indicating she should take a bite. Sometimes this was enough. Leave the thought for a moment. Break the cycle just long enough to get off the anxiety train. All I remember were people asking me questions, Patty said. I told the police the others had been out in the woods as well. Then my dad came and took me home. We all went home. Everything stopped. Camp, life in general. The only thing that happened after that was a big gathering in town. Some of us met up on the football field at school. I was there with Greg. He was drunk and high, so the usual. We fought, which was also usual. And he got on his motorcycle, no helmet, of course, and rode off. There's a sharp turn up the road from the school, a really nasty one. There are accidents there all the time. Stevie remembered the turn from that morning's drive. It was almost 90 degrees, bordered on one side by a large wall of rock. He knew the turn well, Patty went on. But everything was so confused that week. He was too drunk or too stoned or just distracted. I don't know, but he crashed. He died on the way to the hospital. My friends were all gone. Patty spread her hands on the table and looked at them. If therapy had been more common, my dad would have put me into it, she said. As it was, all he really understood was hard work and business. He talked me into getting serious about baking, since it was the one thing I really liked to do. He pushed me into culinary school, and it helped. I threw myself into it completely. You work long hours in bakeries and kitchens. You sweat it out.
Mentally, I recovered by chopping and mixing and standing in front of stoves and ovens. I changed. My father fronted the money for me to open this place. I'm glad my dad got to see my business get off the ground before he died. That's why I keep his picture up in here. He was my angel investor. He believed in me. I tried to make something good come out of the horror of it all. After a polite pause to let the gravity of what had been said settle, Stevie picked up her questioning. "What did you think happened?" she asked. "I know there have been questions about the woodsman, but that's the only thing that ever made sense to me. That guy or someone copying him. I don't know if you watched much true crime, but there were a lot of serial killers back then." Nate actually guffawed. That was the only word for it. This confused Patty for a moment, but she disregarded it. "I think some sicko went into the woods and killed my friends, and we'll always be replaying the events. We're always going to be the town with the murders. It'll never stop. After you, there will be someone else. It's our story, and we have to live with it. But I try to make something beautiful here, something people can enjoy. I called this place Sunshine Bakery because that's the vibe I want to give off. The truth is, this is a nice place, and the camp is a great place to spend the summer. I had so many good times.